Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on whether these new immigration measures really will make the U.S. safer.
No hate! No fear! Refugees are welcome here!
No hate! No fear! Refugees are welcome here! No hate.
President Trump argues that the vetting currently going on for refugees and would-be immigrants isn't strict enough, even though people trying to come to the U.S. from a place like Syria face years of vetting. But let's take his concerns and his claims at face value and check some facts against it. And I hope to hear from you this morning. Do you believe that allowing fewer people to enter the United States is an important way to diminish the threat of terrorism? Do you think the president is using measures that are proportionate to the risks posed by potential terrorists? So I'd like to know whether you see this immigration policy, particularly if you supported President Trump, if you see this immigration policy as an important way to diminish the threat of terrorism, and then whether you think the president is using measures that are proportionate to the risks posed by terrorism. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter. You can reach me here at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Michael Hurley, is a former CIA officer. He's an advisor to the chairs of the 9/11 Commission, and he's president of an international strategy company called 3i. Michael, welcome back to the show. Good to have you on.
Hi, Carrie. Good morning.
Sharon Burke is with us. She's a former Defense Department staffer in the Obama administration, a senior international security advisor at the New America Foundation. And Sharon, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Sharon, the president tweeted over the weekend on his immigration ban that there is nothing, quote, nice about hunting down terrorists, but there are, quote, a lot of bad dudes out there. I wondered about whether a lot of those bad dudes are trying to get into the U.S. through visa or green card application processes or through the usual immigration processes where they would be, where they would have background checks. Is that the way they do it?
Well, I mean, there's two different answers to that. The first is that if you look at the record of terrorist attacks that have happened in the United States, that's not actually borne out. And my colleagues here at New America, led by Peter Bergen, have done a thorough analysis, have been for years keeping a database of absolutely everyone who has jihadist sympathies. And is so I'm not talking about all terrorist attacks, just with jihadist sympathies. And most of the people that commit those attacks are actually U.S. citizens who were born here, or and then some who are legally here. None of the people that have been involved in attacks have been from the countries that are mentioned in this ban. So just looking at the history, the quick answer is, well, no, this isn't the right way to go. But, you know, to be fair, the administration's not wrong in being concerned and wanting to keep the country safe. You know, I think the kinds of attacks that we've seen in Paris and Brussels, that we've seen in Lebanon, that we've seen in many countries around the world, we're an open society. We're certainly not immune to it. But it's really difficult to get at exactly how you make the country safer. And this gesture in that direction, there's no reason to believe it'll make us safer based on the history of everyone who's conducted attacks in the United States in the past.
So, Michael, given what Sharon just said, let's actually quote from the executive order. It says, numerous foreign-born individuals have been convicted or implicated in terrorism-related crimes since September 11th, including foreign-born nationals who enter the United States after receiving visitor, student, or employment visas, or who enter through the United States refugee resettlement program. Is that factually true?
I think it's an overstatement. I agree with the points that Sharon made, and I've read the analyses of New America and familiar with Peter Bergen's work, and I agree that most of the attacks that we've had post 9/11 in the United States have been by folks that U.S. citizens, basically. You know, it is, going back to your first question, it is always possible that a terrorist or somebody who wishes to do something really bad here in the United States might go through the visa process, and we'll know that when it happens the first time. But My overall impression in terms of what the Trump administration seems to be doing, I go back to my experience carry on the 9/11 Commission.
Uh-huh.
And we made 41 recommendations to keep the country safe. And a lot of them were passed into legislation very quickly. I think that's important. But something else that we said was that these would not be static. We didn't claim that these recommendations would keep the country safe for all time. They have to evolve. The threat will evolve. And I think it's good to have fresh eyes. One thing I didn't like during the campaign was there was just so much rhetoric about how our system of controlling our borders is failing. I think that may be true of our southwestern border. But overall, I think we made vast improvements in the security and the vetting of people coming into the United States. Candidate Trump talked a lot about extreme vetting. I never quite understood what that meant.
I wanted to get to that. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, just in general, making improvements, having some fresh eyes is probably a good thing.
So, Sharon, Michael said something interesting there with the threat will evolve. And that's why I included in my question to our listeners, do you think these measures are proportionate to the risk? We can't deny that there's a risk, can we?
No, we can't deny that there's a risk, and nor can we deny that the risk is growing because the number of attacks around the world have been increasing. So there's a risk. I think there's always going to be some risk. And so I think, first of all, someone who tells you that they can make this airtight and you will never be at any risk is lying to you. On the other hand, I think people also perceive the risk in a personal way that's not borne out by the numbers. You know, you see opinion polling where Americans will say, I feel that I'm at, you know, a reasonable risk personally of being attacked by a terrorist. And if you look at the statistics, that's just not true. However, there is a risk. It is growing. We do need to take it seriously. And the problem is, again, it's not so much that they're wrong in saying there's a risk, let's look at it. But if you misdirect the policy, and especially with the kind of language and aggressive action they've taken up front, you may actually be making the risk worse. And I think that's one of the real problems here, is that of the attacks that have happened in the United States, you know, 188 of them were from U.S.-born citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And when my colleagues have looked into their motivations for doing that, they're complicated. There's rarely a single reason, but a lot of it has to do with disaffectation. They don't like U.S. policy against Muslim countries. They don't like their own personal life, whatever it is. Some have mental health issues. It's usually a complicated mix. However, this kind of really inflammatory rhetoric and violent rhetoric, and especially when you match it with what the president has said, such as we're going to give preference to Christians, is likely to make the problem worse, not better, because this is so complicated about why people do these things.
Sharon, I just want to grab a call here from, I think, somebody who's asking specifically about the motivation. Mike, is that right? Is that what you wanted to ask?
That's exactly right. Good morning. I think we should spend some time talking about the grievances of those we designate as terrorists. And perhaps if we find those grievances valid, we should stop doing those things. And, of course, I'm talking about things like military aggression and torture, indefinite detention like what Guantanamo Bay, support for repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, and drone strikes that kill so many civilians. You know, this is a mutually declared global war, and it won't end by military action, and it won't end by, you know, giving up our constitutional rights. It will end with a negotiated settlement.
Mike, let me go to Michael Hurley on that. Michael?
Well, it's a little difficult to unpack all those points. There's some interesting ones in there. But as Sharon was saying, I mean, I think that the motivations for terrorists are many, and you know, they can range from alienation, from the sense of just not belonging to the societies that they're in, that somehow they haven't been integrated well. There's just a whole range of things, and you know, a lot of them are young men, and you know, addressing what will how to get at this. It's really difficult to determine, you know, what's going on in the dark corners of some person's mind. And we see this in the United States. Like, you know, the teenager who's sort of sitting in the basement online, engaging in blogs. There's so many of them now that, you know, are promoting extremist behavior and so on. So, you know, the motivations are really, there's a lot of them.
Well, Michael, I'm thinking of the Fort Hood shooter. I mean, this is somebody who's in the military, who apparently has had some kind of background checking. You don't know how that person, as you've just said, mental illness, radicalization, what's going on. And it's probably impossible to stop absolutely everyone. Isn't it, Sharon, you were going to say?
That's definitely part of it. I also, with the caller, you know, as Michael said, there are some things in his statement that I think I would love to unpack and go into. But first, I got to say, I just categorically disagree that making concessions to ISIS is going to make us safer. This feeling that if we just leave the world and leave someone like ISIS to their devices, that they're entitled to their violent anarchic takeover of the places they live, and that it doesn't involve our interests. I just reject that.
Sharon, are you speaking to what Mike was saying about the drone strikes and some of the
correct.
Other policies that we're doing? Okay.
Right, and that his feeling that if we just leave, everything will be all right. That's just not true. And I think making concessions to a group like that would be a huge mistake. So, and not only that, but as Michael was saying, it also won't stop what's going on, because what we've seen is a lot of the folks who have been motivated in the United States by jihadist ideology are learning it, as he said, online. Mm. That the rise of social media as a factor, it doesn't matter, you know, where we are in the world or what we're doing, that's going to be a factor no matter what. So making concessions to violent extremists in the hopes that they'll leave us alone is really not true.
A call here from Brian in Columbia Heights. Hey, Brian, thank you for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I just think, you know, it's just a temporary ban. I mean, it's not forever. And we need to take a look at what's going on and also what's happened in Europe. And are we supposed to take in every refugee of the world? I mean, I know that we've created a lot of this mess because of our wars overseas. And that's some of my thoughts.
Okay. So, Michael, as Brian points out, for now, this is I believe, a 90-day change in immigration policy for people from seven countries. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I do think that the Trump administration is kind of talking about the temporary nature of it. I do think that it was overbroad, and I think it was, I mean, quite obviously badly implemented. And part of that is that this new administration doesn't yet know kind of the mechanisms of government, and they flat out made some mistakes in implementing the policy. I think that you need to actually circulate these policies among your close advisors, and some of these very able people that have been appointed our Secretary of Defense and our Secretary of Department of Homeland Security, and even some of the congressional leaders. They would all, I think, made suggestions that would have avoided some of the confusion in implementing this executive order.
But Michael, let me ask you this. Okay on the execution, but, I mean, is the Trump administration correct in looking at this list of seven countries? And yes, we can say, well, why isn't Pakistan on it? Why isn't Saudi Arabia on it? But is it, you said it's a good thing to have some fresh eyes. Are they looking at this with the kind of perspective that you would want them to bring to that question?
No, I don't think so, because as I said, I think it's overly broad. I don't think the evidence shows that you need to ban even temporarily for 90 days, you know, the entire populations of these countries, because let's face it, 95-99% of them are coming here for, you know, very peaceful and good reasons that everybody can accept. There may be some bad actors in all of this, and I think we're just sort of overreaching, and it's being a little bit too overbroad, and I think it's unnecessary. But I do think it's really important to understand what are the mechanisms that are in place. I don't think the American public has a very good appreciation of that, because mm-hmm. I think there was so much fog during the election, and those issues got so conflated with the 40 years of problems we've had with our southwestern border, and I think they're different issues. We do have pretty robust vetting systems in place. They can be improved. I think those vetting systems should be applied to these seven countries, but probably to a number of other countries that hopefully we have been, you know, using some, you know, extreme vetting already. But if new steps, if someone has good ideas that can make us even more safe, I'm all for that.
Sharon, go ahead.
Sorry, first of all, the ban is for 90 days on all immigration, and one of the problems why it's been so messy is that it's caught legal residents of the United States who are here legally in the ban. It's everything is forbidden, and that is an absolute mess, and it's, as better people than I have written, it's already in litigation. It's a mess. Secondly, and also because the president has made it clear in his public comments that there's a religious element to that, and we, by law, do not discriminate based on religious belief, but also there's a 120-day ban suspension of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, and both of these bans are renewable by just a statement of the president. So it's not clear that they're temporary, first of all. They are extreme in who they apply to. So they don't just apply to refugees from Libya who might be affiliated with a terrorist group. Mm-hmm. They apply to absolutely everyone.
Right.
Like,
right.
I heard the other day a friend of mine who's from the United Kingdom said that Olympian Mo Farah was in London to be knighted by the Queen.
I saw
and
that.
And he's Somali-born, and he can't get back into the United States. This is a really, like, a fishing expedition that's catching all the wrong things. And whether or not it catches the right things, I don't know, but it's definitely agitating everybody in a way that's not going to be helpful. Fresh eyes, great, but why make such an extreme, especially against refugees? I just want to say again, of all the attacks that have happened in the United States, there have been no one who's been a refugee has been involved. Certainly no one from who's been a Syrian refugee has been involved in any attacks anywhere, as far as I know.
You're hearing some insight and experienced views here from Sharon Burke from the New America Foundation and Michael Hurley, former CIA officer, advises the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. And my question for you as you listen to this discussion develop is whether you believe that allowing fewer people to enter the United States is an important and, what President Trump says, essential way to diminish the threat of terrorism. I also would like you to think about whether you support this or not, whether you think that these measures are proportionate to the risks that the United States faces from terrorists, from outside terrorists, from people within the United States who get radicalized. We know that terrorist attacks have been carried out by people within the borders who end up radicalized. Talk to me about that. Think about that with some nuance here, if you would, this morning. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, at Carrie NPR, Patrick says, the ban increases the risk. It strengthens the ISIS narrative of crusaders versus caliphate. The next terrorist to attack already lives here. And to the phones to Chad in Coon Rapids. Hi, Chad.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
You know, I support the temporary ban.
Uh-huh.
I feel that the administration deserves the time to lay out how they're going to vet incoming, aspiring citizens. I don't think that has been being done the way that they will end up doing it.
Okay.
So, you know, for them to have some time to get the groundwork laid down and have it how they prefer is a right of the new administration, in my opinion.
Michael,
so,
that
to stick with status quo would be, you know, unfair as well.
Okay. Michael, what would you say?
Well, again, I do think that a fresh look is always good, and I always recommend that. One of the issues I have overall, though, and this is a direct result of kind of the polarized politics that we've had for so many years now, but I really do think a bipartisan approach is called for in dealing with these issues. It just, I think, is wrong to come in and sort of have the view that the current system is failing when I don't think that's the case. I think we made a lot of progress in terms of protecting the country across many different agencies in so many ways, in terms of our information sharing that was lacking before 9/11, in terms of our integrating our federal authorities with state and local and the private sector. That's all to the good. And also, I think, in terms of hardening our borders in a way, that is all pretty good. And I think there was so much, I don't know, sort of rhetoric concentrated on saying that none of that was working, that I'm not surprised that a big swath of the public thinks that these sort of really difficult measures need to be employed. I think the system is already pretty rigorous, but it can be improved.
Yeah. Did you just say, Michael, you're not surprised that a large swath of the electorate believes that better measures are necessary? Why?
No, what I was saying was I'm not surprised that a large swath of the population thinks that we're largely unprotected, because that was the rhetoric during the campaign. And I think
it's
many
not
people
true.
Believe that.
But you're saying
no,
it's
I think
not
we're,
true.
I think we're protected, but you know, it always makes sense because, as I said, the threat is constantly evolving, that we need to keep changing as well, too, and keep improving. But this wholesale rejection of the notion that sort of nobody's been doing anything for the last 15 years is ridiculous.
I wanted to bring a couple other if you'll hang on just 1 second, Sharon.
Sure.
I was listening to Mary Louise Kelly's reporting on this yesterday, and she talked with some other national security experts who have similar credentials to our guest today. Here are Phil Mudd and Hank Crumpton on their views of whether these new measures actually make us safer or more vulnerable. Listen.
I don't understand the selection of these countries. What about Pakistan, Afghanistan, Egypt? And if you're worried about people coming into this country, look at where we've seen attacks in the past few years. Countries like Belgium, France, Germany, which have very easy visa access to the United States. Why wouldn't you limit then?
If these potential allies are mistrustful of our country, if they don't hold us in the highest regard when we ask them to risk their lives in cooperation with us, yes, that does put our nation at greater jeopardy, I believe.
Phil Mudd first there, and then Hank Crumpton. And Sharon, what were you going to say?
Well, first of all, I agree with both Hank and Phil what they said, and that, you know, just putting a feel-good statement out there to people that think this makes them safer when this actually might be counterproductive and make us less safe, you know, that's what's at risk here. And, you know, something that the caller, Chad, said really kind of struck me, where he said, you know, the incoming president has the right to change this. Well, yes and no. We are a nation of laws, not just of leaders. And so he also has to look at the laws, and it would be prudent for him to look at what's already being done. And I completely agree with Michael. It's really important for people to understand that since 9/11, we've not had a major foreign terrorist attack in this country. There have been attacks. There have been shootings. They've usually been conducted by U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different matter. But the effort that goes into that, you're talking about FBI, intelligence agencies, our consular offices and embassies overseas, Customs and Border Patrol. There are thousands of Americans every day who are working really hard to protect the country, and they've been really successful. Now, that doesn't mean that there's nothing that can be improved. That doesn't mean that we will never be attacked again. But it's really important to look and realize that we have not had that kind of attack again since 9/11. And trust me, one thing the president's absolutely right about is there's a lot of bad dudes out there. It's not for lack of trying. So we've gotten a lot right. We can always do it better. But this language that somehow, you know, we're failing and we're so vulnerable, I don't believe that. And it doesn't mean that we're perfectly safe all the time. But there's a lot of good people out there who are working really hard to keep the country safe, and they've been succeeding.
Picking up on what Sharon said, I think we need to get to the position where, because we will have an attack. I don't think it will be on a scale anywhere near 9/11, but we'll have some attacks in this country. And when that happens, how are we going to respond to that? Is it just going to be finger pointing, or is it going to be to go through the sadness that accompanies it and then figure out what went wrong? How do we need to fix it? How do we make the system better? What improvements do we need to make rather than to just sort of say, okay, we need to ban a whole group of people because of this?
What terrorists want. They want us to be angry. They want us to change who we are. That's the whole point of a terrorist attack. It's an attack that doesn't have a significant effect necessarily of it on its own accord, but rather it's the reaction is what they're looking for.
You know,
if we do that, we're playing into exactly what they want.
I want to ask you both about, we did a show, months ago about what the American reaction would be if we had another significant terrorist attack in the United States. And I remember our guest, Michael, you might have been part of that conversation. I remember our guest saying at one point that they thought the American people were more cognizant of the reality of the risk than our political leaders were willing to accept. Sharon, do you think that's right?
That the American people are more cognizant of the risk?
Well, and I used the word sophisticated, that it wasn't going to be an immediate the sky is falling again kind of reaction, that we now understand this better. What do you think?
Well, you know, I've done some work on this, on what I call civic resilience and how do people manage their reaction to an event like this. And I actually worry that we think we're ready, right? But I'm not so sure that we are, particularly to something that's talking to social psychologists, what's most likely to cause a problem is something that has a lot of ambiguity. So something like that happened in Mumbai in 2008, where you have multiple shooters ranging the city, hitting public targets without any particular agenda for who they're shooting at, where you don't know that you have the perpetrators caught. You know, so the Boston bombing, the fact that the shooters were at large, the bombers were at large, these things cause a tremendous amount of anxiety. And now in the age where the news, you know, it used to be that news was that people like you were interpreting the news and interpreting for people what's happened, and local authorities and federal authorities were able to give authoritative statements. But now you've got victims, eyewitnesses, and perpetrators who are texting, putting pictures, video in real time, who are framing the story. So, you know, Omar Mateen took pauses in the shooting at Pulse to post to Facebook and to see if he was trending.
In Orlando, the Orlando nightclub shooter.
Correct, yeah. Over the summer. So, right. I mean, this is a whole new ballgame, and I don't think we're as ready as we think we are for an attack like that. I think in Washington, what was really instructive was the sniper attack that happened here, where it was two shooters, one a juvenile, and they really held this city, you know, and lockdown, and it was a terribly uncomfortable time. And again, multiple day, a lot of ambiguity. We're not as ready as we think we are.
Michael, would you speak to this?
Well, if you go back to the 9/11 attacks, which were on such a massive scale, but the country was shocked, but we really shouldn't have been surprised, because I won't take the time, but I could rattle off a dozen sort of major attacks from al-Qaeda that had taken place in the immediate years before 9/11, and yet a lot of people in the country had not heard of who Osama bin Laden was, because I guess maybe they weren't paying attention or our leaders weren't making it clear to them on the day of the 9/11 attacks. So in one sense, I think, you know, we have that sense of greater awareness, and people are, you know, I think they if they see something, they will probably, you know, sort of know what steps to take. But I just, it partly would depend on the scale of an attack. One thing I do know is that we will be much better at responding to it, I think, in a unified way, in a coordinated way, and I think that's a positive step forward.
Jane
one
says,
thing
on
we found in our research is that how the first responders and local leaders react and the kind of language they use really determines how people react. And the other thing is, there's a great psychologist at UC Irvine, Roxanne Cohen, who's studied this. Actually, what they find is the people who really read the most about attacks and about these kinds of things are the most traumatized by what happens. So even though we should be more comfortable with what this looks like, we're actually, the people who are most knowledgeable are most likely to be traumatized.
Jane says on Twitter, Trump's lack of understanding of current immigration practice and his failure to communicate in advance caused chaos and more problems. Ivan says, He doesn't think the ban is proportional. Fighting terrorism needs nuance. It's a sledgehammer where we need a scalpel, too much collateral damage. And Steph, off the page.
Connie says, I don't buy the argument that this ban will be a terrorist recruitment fodder. Nobody who wasn't already unstable and flirting with extremism becomes an extremist overnight. I do disagree with this ban, however, on moral and religious grounds stemming from compassion.
Call here from Nate in Plymouth. Hi, Nate.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I have a question for Michael.
Sure.
Michael mentioned that he believes that all these seven countries should be included. My question is if anybody or in the administration is aware of the difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis and how all these attacks have been perpetuated by Sunni extremists. And the country of Iran, which is 97.8% Shiite, is included in the list.
Michael?
I'm happy to respond to that. And when I said that the seven countries should be included, I made the point that the executive order is way, way overbroad, and Sharon has given some of the specific examples of what that did. So I just wanted to point that out. Well, there certainly are people in the new administration and in the permanent government that know the difference between Sunni and Shia, of course. But it does raise an interesting point because I'd have to go back and look at the executive order, which allows, I think, from these countries kind of preference to religious minorities. And in Iraq, for example, now the Sunnis would be the minority to the Shia, and it's the Sunnis that at least there seem to be more terrorists coming from that the sort of branch of Islam. So the caller raises an interesting point.
Sharon,
Iran is a state sponsor. I mean, under U.S. law, three of the countries mentioned in the ban are state sponsors of terrorism. So it's not clear on what basis they chose these countries, but one of the defensible bases is including Iran, Sudan, and Syria because they're listed as state sponsors of terrorism. But I would point out with Syria, that means President Assad. Not the terrorist groups that are operating in this territory.
Sharon, do you believe, as we've all noted here, that this is a what Donald Trump says is a temporary ban? Do you have the sense that this is going to continue, or do you think the uproar and his opportunity to change some of the so-called vetting procedures will make him rethink this?
I wish I knew. I think he is I don't see the president being the kind of guy that backs down just because people are upset. However, the Secretary for Homeland Security, John Kelly, and the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, are both truly great Americans and know this world very well. And I assume that they will make a solid case for, as I think one of your very smart audience members pointed out, that this is a blunt instrument, and I think that they will be looking to make it a more fine-tuned one. And, the main thrust of this executive order, once you get past the odious language and the horrible bans, is it basically says do a report and tighten your consular, your border procedures, which are, I think, most of the things they listed as things they want Border Patrol and consular officers to do are things they already do. So the actual action of this beyond the bans are not that big a deal. So if it's up to those two cabinet secretaries, I do think you'll see a revision of this and the ban won't continue. But that's anybody's guess.
Sharon, a pleasure to have you. I hope you'll come back.
Anytime.
Thank you. Michael, thank you so much. We really rely on your insight and your expertise here, and I'm grateful that you share it with us. Thank you.
My pleasure, Carrie.
Michael Hurley with us currently advises the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission. Sharon Burke with us, a senior advisor at New America.